This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The trickle of bad news about Facebook, or as it's just been rebranded, Meta, has turned into a torrent. Weeks ago, we learned that the company knows that Instagram, for example, which it owns, causes serious mental distress for many teenagers. And the release of thousands of company documents, known as the Facebook Papers, contains a staggering number of missteps and misdeeds. Facebook's indifference to how it accelerates the circulation of toxic and false information, its participation in corroding civil and democratic society, are now just impossible to ignore. The journalist Maria Ressa shared a Nobel Peace Prize in October for her work to protect freedom of expression. There we are. Maria, how are you?
Oh, good. It's one of those days of like cascading meetings. And they.
Ressa runs the digital news organization Rappler, which is based in the Philippines. And she's been the target of hate campaigns by supporters of President Rodrigo Duterte over and over again. At first, Ressa believed Facebook would be critical to the success of her enterprise and journalism in general, but she soon became one of Facebook's most vocal and informed critics. I want to read to you something that you've said, and I want to expand on it. You said this: I think that the rollback of democracy globally and the tearing apart of shared reality has been because of tech. It's because news organizations lost our gatekeeping powers to technology, and technology took the revenues that we used to have, and they took the powers, but they abdicated responsibility. These revelations have made clearer, what the problem is with Facebook and social media in the way you've been describing it. I guess the next question we have to ask is what is to be done, to repeat the famous question. Facebook, not to do their work for them, but Facebook would charge to the microphone and say, look, we have spent millions upon millions of dollars to do better. We've essentially hired a kind of Supreme Court to adjudicate some of these difficult questions and hired and brought in some extremely prestigious minds from the world of journalism and academia and all the rest. We have tried to strip away as much hate speech as we possibly can, but it comes in a torrent and we can't get everything. Do you have any sympathy for this argument?
And none.
So go ahead. Go ahead.
None. You know, and I get it on both ends, right? Because what Facebook has enabled is an environment where my government has been able to file 10 arrest warrants against me in less than 2 years. Mm. Okay. Now, Facebook, these companies didn't set out to be news organizations. So they actually don't have standards and ethics or the mission to protect the public sphere. But that's also where regulation must come in, because that is exactly what they're doing. These platforms are the connective tissue of society. These platforms determine our reality. They exploit the weaknesses of our biology to actually shift behavior, to shift the way you think. If the way you think shifts, then the way you behave shifts, right? January 6th is a perfect example of that, right? So I don't even know where to begin.
You're doing great. So I guess, keep charging on. Go ahead.
Well,
you said January 6th was a perfect example.
Well, again, was that a surprise for any of us who live on Facebook? It wasn't, because we were seeing this. So think about it like, I'm going to do three assumptions that the platforms do that just drive me crazy as a journalist. The first is that, you know, if you don't like something, if a lie is told about you, or if you just don't like something, mute it. If it's a lie that is tearing down your credibility, does muting it help? Number one. Number two, that more and faster is better. It really isn't, you know, and that's part of it. I think the kind of friction that is necessary to stop the spread of lies isn't even in the calculation, because that's not in the design. And then I think the third part is that all of us have our own realities. Which democracy can survive when you have almost 3 billion Truman shows and we are each performing, not to mention the impact on the individual who is performing, right? So the shift in behavior is real, and it is exploited by governments like mine.
If Facebook is incapable of, for all the reasons we know, of dealing with this torrent, the next step is the government, in some way, being in charge of that. And I think both you and I were raised to think that the government being in charge of determining what is fact and what is not fact, and what is legitimate speech and what is hate speech, is complicated, to say the least.
But that's not what they should be doing. It's not about content. And that's where you run into the free speech issues, right? It's because that's downstream. Go upstream to the problem, the design of the platform. There must be radical transparency for what is going into these algorithms that are determining our realities. So if you go there, you bypass this. Why are fake accounts being allowed to proliferate at the scale that they do? Right? Even as early as 2017, Facebook's footnotes in its disclosure said that the Philippines had more than the normal average of fake accounts. So they know when an account is fake. So it's like playing a whack-a-mole game. Legislation should deal with fraud. It should deal with the same laws that are the actions that are illegal in the real world should be mirrored in the virtual world. Right? You don't have to recreate reality. You don't have to have new definitions. Part of our problem, I think, is that we're trying to find new words for that algorithmic bias. Because in the end, while the platforms will say the algorithms are a machine, they are programmed, you know, and they reflect the biases of the programmer, which is also why my country's, you know, coded bias. I don't know if you saw that film, right? There's an MIT student who couldn't do an AI experiment until she put a white face on because of the coded bias. So that's part of the problem, is that these American social media platforms, these American companies, have exported their bias. And it is insidiously built into our Philippines, any other country's information ecosystem.
A lot of people are calling for the breaking up of Facebook and for Mark Zuckerberg, if not to step down entirely, to be in charge of a realm of Facebook that would be much diminished. How do you look at that problem? And would that solve anything?
I don't know the right answer to that. Right, because I do think that we're Facebook country, the Philippines. 100% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. I believed in the power of Facebook before they betrayed my beliefs. But when we started Rappler in 2012, our rallying cry, we asked people to go on Facebook. Our rallying cry was social media for social good. social media for social change. I had hoped that we could use technology to jumpstart development and build institutions bottom up.
So you feel betrayed by that?
Yeah, I was naive, right? I didn't think that the money, I mean, because in the end, they're using a scorched earth policy. The same way that the Duterte administration is using a scorched earth policy. The generation after is going to have to pay for everything that's been done now. That's the same thing that Facebook is doing. It doesn't make sense unless the money in the short term is worth it for them. Let me put it this way.
Well, do you believe that Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg and company blundered into the problems that they've got now, or they knew all along exactly what they were doing and didn't care?
I can't call them evil, at least not yet, right? Because that's kind of what it is. That is it that surveillance capitalism is, can you do it even if people are dying? Although I ask this question all the time, who is responsible for genocide in Myanmar? It isn't just the military. It isn't just the groups that seeded that, right? Or the killings in the Philippines, which were enabled, right? They changed reality. They saw it coming, but by digging in his heels, and I guess you go back to Mark Zuckerberg and the kind of power he has. When I met him, I was struck by how smart he is. Intelligent, David. You know, like he knows the technology. But what he didn't realize, I think, was the impact of this. He looks at it in terms of, you know, do you remember that quote of his? It's only 1%.
Yeah, I think what Zuckerberg was getting at is his claim that less than 1% of what's on Facebook is fake news.
1% of how much is how much? And what is the impact of that? For a journalist, one error is too much, right? So it's kind of like saying, oh, well, we can have some poison in the environment. Let's say it's a body, in our body. We can have poison in there, but that poison spreads and it will kill.
It's 1% cyanide. In your dinner. Maria, do you extend your critique of social media to Twitter and Google as well as Facebook equally?
I do, but each platform is different. So I will say for search, right, the page ranking, I mean, if you look at all of the things that are there, it's better thought out. It has a lot more inputs into it, and they're more transparent.
We're talking about Google now.
Yes, Google search. Right? YouTube, on the other hand, could do with a bit more, right? In the Philippines, YouTube is now number one. Twitter in the United States is different from the Philippines. I feel more protected on Twitter than I do on Facebook. And that's why you'll see me there more than I am on Facebook, even though Facebook is essentially still our internet.
Was the initial conceit the original sin? In other words, the original conceit of Facebook was, we are not a publisher. We are merely a platform. We're providing a global Hyde Park corner where everybody can say what they want and exchange information where they want. Was that the original sin?
I think the original sin was when they got rid of, you know, it worked really well when it was Facebook and they had, you had to have your campus ID. You knew who you were, and the news feed was chronological. That's the first, right? Then they tweaked it over time, and the news feed is now no longer chronological, the personalization part, right? That's a tech construct again, right? It's personalization. Think about it, David. Did that make sense? That you are given everything you want, that your cognitive bias is fueled by more of what you want? Is that really the right thing? I think this is part of the reason our values of, you know, our world is slightly turned upside down, because we've adapted this hook, line, and sinker. Personalization is better. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, it does make the company more money, but is that the right thing? Because personalization also tears apart a shared reality.
Maria Ressa runs the news site Rappler in the Philippines. There's more to come today on the deep and frightening problem of misinformation that's affecting democracies all over the world, including our own. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I tend to think that real life is scary enough, especially these past few years, without having to gin up new scares for Halloween. But some of you I know have spent the whole month of October binging on scary stories. Ghost stories and zombie stories and serial killers with saws and hockey masks and candy. So before that's all over, we've got another one for you. Here's staff writer Andrew Morantz on the horrors of the internet, real and imagined.
Human beings have always liked scary stories. And there is pleasure in a scary story that is totally made up in a hypothetical land far, far away. But I think we all know from experience that the scariest kind of story are the ones where you think, maybe some part of this could possibly be real. This is something we've understood throughout the history of telling scary stories. For example, one of the first horror novels was called The Castle of Otranto. It was published in 1764. It's obviously fictional, right? It's about a haunted castle in Italy. But there's this preface to the book where the author says, actually, what you're about to read is real.
The following work was found in the library of an ancient Catholic family in the north of England. The scene is undoubtedly laid in some real castle.
And then from there, you can trace a really rich history of every time there's been a new step in communication and mediation, horror stories have been there to play with it.
This is Joe Ondrak. Joe is an expert in scary stories. In fact, he's working on a doctorate in them.
You know, you have the mass-produced popular novel, and you have things like Dracula and the first edition of Frankenstein, which were both published as this epistolary, maybe fact, maybe fiction.
The sun does not more certainly shine in the heavens than that which I now affirm is true.
From there, you can trace it to things like the famous War of the Worlds broadcast in radio, which again was playing with it.
There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames.
And then, you know, most famously, you have the Blair Witch Project and the revolution in, you know, handheld cameras.
Oh, we're doing a documentary about the Blair Witch.
Oh,
have you heard of the Blair Witch?
Oh, yeah. That's an old story.
So my whole thing that I absolutely love with texts has always been this teasing at the boundaries between fact and fiction. And it just seemed like a natural progression to study creepypasta.
Let's just pause on that word for a second. The word Joe just said is creepypasta. So yes, creepy as in scary, pasta as in noodles. It is admittedly a really silly word, but this is the internet, and often totally silly words can refer to things that are actually worth paying attention to.
So the very, very basic version of creepypasta is it is a form of horror fiction that is written on the internet for the internet.
So the way creepypasta works is it uses things like social media or online forums, YouTube even, as tools in telling the story. And not only can you take it in by reading it or watching it, but you can also participate in it. If all that feels a little academic, maybe it's easier to just look at one concrete example. A creepypasta that Joe really likes, it's called Candle Cove.
So Candle Cove is an interesting example because that one, it was originally published online as a fiction. So it was originally written by a chap named Chris Straub on his website.
Okay, I have it. I just pulled it up here. Subject, Candle Cove local kids show. Does anyone remember this kids show? It was called Candle Cove, and I must have been 6 or 7. Okay, so it just starts like that.
I never found reference to it anywhere, so I think it was on a local station around 1971 or 1972. I lived in Ironton.
So the original Candle Cove narrative, in a nutshell, is a message board exchange between a few different people reminiscing about a children's television show.
Was it about pirates? I remember a pirate marionette at the mouth of a cave talking to a little girl.
So again, just to be clear, this is a fictional story that is written in the form of message board discussions about a fictional TV show. So as these characters are reminiscing about this show, they then start to remember these more and more upsetting details.
And the puppets and the marionettes were flailing spastically and just all screaming. The girl was just moaning and crying like she had been through hours of this.
Before a final twist that one of the forum members goes to visit his mum in a nursing home.
I asked her about when I was little in the early 70s, when I was 8 or 9, and if she remembered a kids' show, Candle Cove. She said she was surprised I could remember that, and I asked why, and she said, because I used to think it was so strange that you said, I'm gonna go watch Candle Cove now, Mom, and then you would tune the TV to static and just watch dead air for 30 minutes. You had a big imagination with your little pirate show.
So, basically, some people read this story on this spooky website, and either because they think it would be a funny joke, or because they want to mess with themselves, or for whatever reason people do things on the internet, they then copy that text, they go to some other website, which could be an actual web forum about actual old TV shows, and they repost the story there.
And then you start finding that the new people, the people who are newly exposed to this, start to believe it.
Yeah, or at least start to give the appearance that they believe it. And from there, a more interesting development happened, which is as it gained popularity, people started to create videos of what they thought Candle Cove, the show, would actually look like.
So suddenly, you have people creating a real show that you can actually watch on YouTube that looks like the fake show that was being described in that fictional scary story.
That's the moment where things really start to get destabilized in terms of fact or fiction.
Because in some sense, then there is a TV show or a video or something called Candle Cove that does exist in the world.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, so to that point, like, you know, as you say, trying to participate in stories or warp the boundaries between fact and fiction is as old as the horror genre itself. What about the internet gives people new tools to play with those boundaries that didn't exist in film or novels or whatever?
So one of the big ones is that the networked internet purports to give this immediacy in interaction between people. It's a communications medium, first and foremost, that is direct between different real people. So the spread versions of Candle Cove that were posted to various different forums, they looked entirely like another real person's real posts and experiences. And social media, the internet in general, produces such a volume of information that we have to rely on what's essentially an implicit social contract, that what is on there is representative of our real lives or truthful to a certain extent. And Creepypasta leverages this this trust in order to derive its affect. Its horror scare comes from the fact that we can't verify every piece of information out there, and we have to trust that to a certain extent what is on there is true.
So here's where our scary story about scary stories actually starts to get a lot scarier.
So, but in addition to being a grad student studying creepypasta, you also have a day job, is that right?
So I am head of investigations for a company called Logically. We are a tech company that deals specifically with disinformation campaigns and fake news and navigating information in the social media landscape that it is today.
Probably not what most literature PhDs end up working in.
Not really, but I somehow managed to bridge that gap, and it's been a pretty seamless transition.
Logically is one of many companies that have recently cropped up that try to combat the spread of hate and disinformation online. This was a whole industry that didn't really exist 10 years ago and is now a pretty big deal.
In 2016, just as I was about to start my PhD, the term fake news became front page news. I realized that, you know, they are using the exact same mechanics and the exact same ways in which people engage with fictions to get people to believe far more malicious things.
So what about them look similar, and what are the dynamics that you recognize?
So Creepypasta is interactive because you can not only read it, but you can then choose to copy and paste it and tell it yourself. The same thing can be true of a disinformation narrative. So things like claims around COVID cures or various different claims from, take any conspiracy theory of your pick, really. When we encounter it for the first time, what we see is 95% of the time not going to be the origin of that particular claim or that particular narrative. It's more than likely going to have been adjusted or remixed through the lens of whoever's been posting it. And that gets to a second aspect of overlap, which is the obscuring of origin. A good creepypasta is one that you encounter, you know, 30 spreads away from the original poster. Whereas disinformation campaigns will do their best to obscure any seed post or origin around it. And again, they take off when people are repeating it and spreading it and remixing it for their own receptive audiences. Now, a good example of this is the frazzle drip narrative.
So that's another weird word. The word is frazzle drip. It's just a made-up word that was supposedly the name of a video file found buried on Anthony Weiner's computer hard drive. Frazzle drip.
It's this rumored video of Hillary Clinton conducting an actual child sacrifice. QAnon talks about Hillary Clinton being part of this satanic pedophile elite. And this story is told almost as a creepypasta by believers of QAnon. So it's either, oh, I saw this video, or my friend saw this video, and then they describe it in graphic and intense detail.
What exactly could bring hardened NYPD detectives to vomit and cry? Just reading some details is cause for nightmares, truly horrific nightmares. No one wants to see this video.
There were already a lot of people who hated Hillary Clinton. But if you were a person who hated Hillary Clinton and then you came across a very specific story like Frazzle Drip, And it's one that is using all the same literary techniques that we have been talking about to make you believe that not only is Hillary Clinton politically bad, but she's literally a Satan-worshipping child trafficker. That is the kind of thing that can really heighten the urgency of the situation. So now you're not just someone who wants to talk about how much you dislike Hillary, but you could become someone who thinks there is a crisis happening in the real world and that you need to go out and do something about it. Think Pizzagate or think January 6th.
For people who are sort of sitting at home going, well, what can we do about this? Do you think that you guys can fix it? Or like, what's the next step here?
I don't think fixing it is on the cards. We at Logically and other initiatives to combat disinformation can help people recognize and navigate the sheer amount of information online. The way in which to, say, cut it off at the root doesn't lie with considering it as information. It lies in considering it as narratives that people would want to believe and will then repeat and embody and then tell others. So the larger question then around fixing this issue becomes, why do these people want to believe this?
So it can be frustrating or baffling, frankly, to think about how anyone could believe such obviously false things, that Hillary Clinton and Oprah and Tom Hanks are all in some satanic cult together or whatever the conspiracy theory is. And talking to Joe kind of made me think that it might be less important whether a story is true than whether it's engaging, whether it hooks into our mind, whether it's enjoyable to think about or play around with. And as Joe said, this way of blurring the line between fiction and reality, it's a great way to make a scary story more enjoyable, more participatory. And the internet has made those lines extremely blurry. At this point, you can pretty much live inside a largely fictional universe. You can tell yourself that your opponents are actually inhuman monsters and that boring everyday politics is actually a showdown between the eternal forces of good and evil. Now, in most cases, that's probably not true, but it might be engaging. And once you're fully engaged in that story, it might start to seem sensible to do something really drastic or even violent. And that is a very scary story, one that happens to be true.
Andrew Morantz is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his book on online extremism is called Antisocial. We also heard from Joe Ondrak, who's a researcher for the tech company Logically. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. In 1965, 5 years after Nigeria gained its independence, the playwright Wole Soyinka was already known as an opposition figure. Authorities falsely accused him of armed robbery. And before the country's civil war of the late 60s, Soyinka tried to avert fighting. He was accused of conspiring with rebels and was then imprisoned by the Nigerian government. He's a writer with an astonishing history of putting himself on the line for his political and social commitments. Soyinka has received the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's written more than 24 plays, a vast amount of poetry, several memoirs, essays, and short stories, and just 2 novels. His 3rd novel is out now, nearly 5 decades after the last one. It's called Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth. It's both a political satire and a murder mystery. It involves 4 friends, a secret society dealing in human body parts, and more corruption than any one country can bear. Staff writer Vincent Cunningham spoke to Wole Soyinka at his home in Nigeria.
I really want to talk to you about Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth, a title that I love. I heard that you've been thinking about this story for many years now. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
It's been a little bit overwhelming, I think. I wasn't expecting this kind of reception of it. For me, it's just part of my own creative continuum in a different format. You know, it's like taking time off from theater to write a novel.
Yeah. This is your 3rd novel, and of course, you're known most prolifically for your works of theater, but what is it that the novel does for you that theater doesn't? This change in form, are there necessities that it meets that theater doesn't, and vice versa? What's the form about for you?
What the novel does for me as a medium of expression is to assuage the masochist in me. Because the novel is very taxing. Taxing in the sense that it's tempting to go in so many directions. Theater, for me, is more focused. When you're a narrator and you're juggling a number of characters and they insist on wandering in very willfully in directions which you did not preview, you know, and then you forget where you last saw them and so on. You know, I really praise novelists, those whose métier is a novel. They have a hard time at it.
Yeah, I mean, but you do in this way, and it's interesting to hear you talk about them as in some ways willing themselves, but you offer us this total panoply of great characters. There's a crooked religious leader, there are politicians, a sort of earnest diplomat, a famous doctor. Did you, in the course of writing this book, was there a favorite character that you aligned on? Was there one who was especially willful and sort of surprised you in different ways?
Well, there's no question at all that a number of the characters were, quote-unquote, inspired or triggered into being by personal encounters. I took great pains to ensure that some of the villains knew that they provided the base material. And in fact, I've even met one of them since the novel came out, and came up to me and I said, well, you're coming to me. I hope you realize that you were this in the novel. And it was a politician, and like a good politician, said, oh, prof, that's okay. But I really want to discuss a certain issues with you in the novel. Forget my character. But so the novel does give one that latitude, I must confess. And then you can play variations far more than in theater. I think theater is almost pre-written. By that I mean they are more constricted in case of the theater. And that is one of the reasons why tackling a theme like this human tumult in which I've been existing, watching others survive, me to surviving in my own way, watching that deterioration of society, the novel intuitively struck me as the only medium in which I could actually purge myself of this oppressive sense of a society going haywire.
It's interesting. There is this sense, this dark sense of, as you say, a society going haywire, and it's contrasted against this wonderful title, you know, The Land of the Happiest People on Earth. Now, I heard that this was inspired by the quote-unquote World Happiness Report, where Nigeria was rated one of the happiest countries in the world. First of all, is that true? And what did that reality, if so, what did that present to you artistically?
Well, when I saw that poll, that world report, I thought, look at these people laughing at us. Why are they so cruel? Why are they doing this? Yeah. And then I realized it was supposed to be a serious poll a serious estimate, supposed to be objective, analytical, even scientific.
Yeah.
And so I looked into this. I said, maybe I'm in the wrong place. But when I looked around, it was still a society which I recognized as my own, as the one in which I function. So it stuck in my head for quite a while. This was some years ago. And when I began working on it, it actually began with other titles. Eventually, I suddenly realized, oh, wait a minute, that estimation, that analysis is the exact title I've been looking for.
Hmm. You know, happiness is such a fraught idea. Here in America, of course, we've sort of encoded it into our national myth. You know, the pursuit of happiness has all these echoes.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah.
What does it mean for you? Because, of course, it can be totally vapid, fun-seeking, surface sort of Epicureanism, I guess. But it can also speak to a real joy. What does it mean for you, and why did it fit so well?
It fits so well, of course, because it's an irony. This country, the people in this nation, are not the happiest by no strength of the imagination. And yet, at the same time, if they went deep enough in society, I think they would flee or consign this nation to the place to be during your, what's that season of yours when you hang skeletons all over the place?
Halloween.
November. Halloween. Halloween. Maybe this is Halloween nation.
Yeah.
And they're not going to understand it.
Right, right.
But then again, as I was saying, you do encounter those who extract possibly a measure of contentment, of fulfillment, even of the most meager kind. They're buoyed either by religion or by an ingrained traditional philosophy that the worst is yet to come, and therefore you better enjoy the present. Because Nigerians do celebrate. I mean, that is not a lie. And those people all over the world where Nigerians are, they do salute Nigerians for their spirit of celebration, which is why I took pains to ensure that at least one character represented what the pursuit of happiness might be. Through creativity, through just love of others, through just making others happy, if only for a few moments. So it's a mishmash of ironies, of acknowledgments, of concession, of even a measure of salute to the people. I hope that measure comes out, that element comes out.
Speaking of this issue of happiness and the different places where it can be found, or not found, you know, where it can be promised but not delivered, perhaps. One of those is religion. And a lot of this book turns on a kind of an upswing in religious fundamentalism. Is it okay if I read a very short passage that I just love from this book? It's about a preacher who we get to know better on. His name is Papa Divina. And he has this epiphany. He's on this kind of long comic journey across West Africa. We see him in Liberia, Senegal, Sierra Leone. And he's in Ghana, and he has this epiphany. He's just kind of made this pun on the word a site of prophecy or prophet's site. And he says this, he looked nervously around, hoping that no one else had caught that creative slip, or at least that it had not registered with anyone in that audience with apostolic ambitions. The flash momentarily unnerved him as it inserted profound doubts in his mind. Could it be that he was, after all, the genuine article? That he had indeed responded to an authentic call to prophecy? Prophesite. Why had all his predecessors failed to formulate such an exquisite, indeed mellifluous name for a place of spiritual quest? Could it be that he was, unbeknownst to himself till now, truly called? This person who's clearly a charlatan of a kind, but almost convinces himself that he's not in certain ways. I wanted to talk to you just about this emphasis on fundamentalism. What role did that play for you?
You know, some of the greatest charlatans of religion, of the religious profession, are really very likable people, very lovable people. First of all, they're performers. They enjoy performing. Now, if you enjoy what you're doing, you're a happy person and you infect others with some of that happiness. So even while you are, you know, blathering high attitudes and knowing very well that you are conning your congregation, mm-hmm. you do produce not just happiness, sometimes rapture, genuine, authentic rapture. And so I find very complex people, the genuine religionists. Of course, some of them are just sinister, the fundamentalists, for instance, both of Christianity and of Islam and Hinduism, for instance. You have the fundamentalists. All religions have their fundamentalist sectors, and those are really sinister, dangerous people. They have no sense of humor. They cannot see the pathetic side of life. They cannot even look at themselves in the mirror and give themselves a pat on the back and say, "You charlatan, but today wasn't bad." You know, they're incapable of it.
Yeah.
They just, some of them just kill. They believe, that's it. You kill anybody who doesn't aspire to your level of malevolent conviction. Hmm.
I'd love to talk to you about, you know, over the course of your career, and I feel career is not as capacious a word as I want, you've been able to bring your activism and your intellectualism and your sort of art all onto the same plane, all operating at once. I learned that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is Fela Kuti your cousin?
Fela.
Yes.
Yes, my cousin, Anikulakbo. Yes, of course, yes.
I had not known that, and it struck me as so apt because here was another person whose art and intellect and political sense were all inter-implicated all together. I wonder if just your upbringing made you feel that as a responsibility. Was that a natural step for you to be sort of an activist, politically aware, a true citizen in the deep sense of that word, and also an artist at the same time?
It remains a mystery to me. And why should it be a mystery? It's because, basically, I would rather not be all these things. In other words, an activist. Ask myself, I don't know how often, how on earth did you get on this path? Why don't you just stick to what you love, really love doing?
Yeah.
Just writing bits of poetry, writing plays, directing plays, exchanging ideas, getting into arguments simply because we live also with abstractions. And anybody who believes in the essence of things, the theory of things, loves the discourse about them. And this I enjoy, which is also why I'm also a teacher by profession. I would rather be doing all those things, honestly. But I end up using that expression, a closet masochist, for myself, because I'm doing certain things which I know I would rather not be doing. But I also love my peace of mind, my tranquility, and I cannot attain that. That's a contradiction. I know I cannot attain that if I have not attended to an issue, a problem, which I know is pernicious, which I know is manifesting itself in a dehumanizing way in others, whether human beings, environment, child abuse, for instance. So we're not just talking about politics.
Right.
We're just talking about humanity. This is one of me. I remain restless when I see such situations. And the only way I can attain that peace, which I love so much, and which I only very sparsely enjoy, that's what drives one out again and again and again. Using other means when one's literature fails to address the issue, then of course you have to address it frontally, physically, by whatever means.
Yeah. I love how you just said that your pursuit of tranquility has in some ways required that you get yourself into trouble in these other ways. You know, it seems like there's not much glory to be had among your own people when you are confronting them in this way. It seems like a fraught position. Just on a personal level, have you made peace with that, or is it a constant?
It's a constant. If I am to be at peace with myself, I must confront the unacceptable from whichever side. Of course, the state has certain statutory responsibilities, so the state gets it more than the people themselves.
Hmm. I love a quote in your book. There are two friends who really form the heart of this book who are speaking at one point, and one of them delivers one of the book's most affecting lines for me. He says, "Something is broken beyond race, outside color or history. Something has cracked, can't be put back together." That something, that sort of ineffable something that's beyond all of the ideology and all of anything that we can put our finger to. I wonder if writing this book helped you put a name to that ineffable something, and have maybe the politics of the last few years helped you to identify or reconsider what it might be.
You know, I've tried to put my finger on it, and I end up with the question, what is human?
Hmm.
And I think that's what we've lost. It has gone on for too long, that condition of losing what is human. From the most profound aspects of our relationships to the most trivial,
mm-hmm.
We lost what is human.
As a way to say goodbye, we mentioned Fela Kuti, your late cousin. Do you have a favorite song of his?
My favorite is Zombie. The reason, actually, is one that's not appreciated by most people. That song, Zumbi, applies not merely to the military in terms of their conduct to the people in this nation. But Zumbi, and that is what Nigerians have not yet realized, they have become mimic people. They act like zombies. They expect orders, even if those orders are intolerable. They develop habits that they should not develop. So when I hear Zombie, I see not merely SARS, those murdering police. I see not merely the bullying soldiers. I see also what Nigerians have become. So I enjoy Zombie on many more levels than the average Nigerian does.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful, and I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Staff writer Vincent Cunningham speaking with Nobel laureate Wally Soyinka. His new novel is Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth. And that's it for us this week. And if you missed anything from today's program, you can find it all on the podcast of our show, wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Priscilla Alabi and Harrison Heathline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.